Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 5 of The Hidden Lives of Writers. Gail, when we started this, did you think we were going to get to this point?
I cannot believe, you know, every email you've sent out, like, booking writers, and it says Season 5, and I'm like, Season 5? Like, how did we get here? How has this happened? I honestly cannot believe, first of all, how much fun it's been. Second of all, that we've kept it up, that we've stuck with it, mm-hmm. and that here we are with Season 5 and a whole lot of exciting guests already lined up.
I know, and we have a very exciting one today in particular, someone that we've been trying to get actually for a couple of years and are very happy to have bagged now as she's got a new release. But let's start off where we normally start off. How has your writing week been?
So because it's the beginning of a new season, there's a very particular aspect of my writing week I want to talk about, because I think maybe people need to hear this at the beginning of a new season. I have made a very conscious decision, and this week I have stuck to it very well, that first part of my day is for writing. Mm-hmm. I think it's a big challenge when you have a busy day job, because you sit down at your desk and you start thinking about that thing you didn't finish yesterday and that email that arrived last night and it was a really irritating person and you've composed the perfect response to them in your head and you want to get that out. And that to-do list is looming over you. Mm. Now, I start my day quite early because I have kids who go to school and we drop fairly early. So depending who I take to school, I'm either at my desk by 7:15 or 7:45. And what I have decided is that if it's 7:15, then that time up till 8 is writing time. If it's 7:45, then up to 8:30 is writing time. And I'm not allowing myself to open the emails to quickly, because what I used to do is I'd say it was writing time. Mm-hmm. And then I'd just quickly deal with this one little thing that's bothering me. And I'd tell myself that I was doing it because I'd be able to focus better if I got that thing. Mm-hmm. And then I never mm-hmm. would get to the writing. And then suddenly it would be the end of the day and I hadn't done it and I felt crap about myself. So now I'm doing it strictly. The writing itself, well, I'll tell you about that next week. But the routine is working for me. It's hard. It's really, really hard to resist the call of the other things, mm-hmm. but it's working.
Oh, I actually needed to hear that now, because I was being good about ring fencing that writing time at the beginning of the day and really protecting it. And now I'm in the mindset of, let me just get this thing out of the way and let me get that out of the way and I'll be more able to concentrate if that's out of the way. And those things, those admin-y things, are just eating into my time so much that it's now kind of mid-morning before I'm even getting started. And my concentration's already a bit splintered.
And you're tired. You don't, you know, you want to keep that best brain for the writing. Sorry, day job, but you want to keep the best brain for the writing. Mm. And for many, many people, the first thing in the morning brain is the best brain.
Mm. It certainly is for me. And I think I need to remember that and get back to that.
Have you managed to do any writing this week?
I have, yes. I get the words in. I prefer to get them in at the beginning of the day in one sort of block, and when it comes easily and comes in a rush, it feels better. But I've been doing it, however bitty and scattered and splintered it might be, I have been getting the words written. And I'm now very much towards the end of a project. In previous episodes, I've talked about a literary novel that I'm mm-hmm. trying to write. And what I'm grappling with at the moment is the possibility that I've tried to tackle too many issues in one book. I don't know if you've ever had this, where you thought, oh, I'm going to write about this, and I'm going to write about that, and I'm going to write about that other thing. And all my kind of pet issues are being written onto the page, and I'm happy because I'm cramming them all in. But I'm not completely convinced that a manuscript where everything is crammed in is necessarily the best product. Do you have any idea? Can you relate it all to what I'm talking about?
Not even in the slightest. I think it might be a danger of setting out to write a literary book. Mm. I think that is the trap of writing a literary novel, where you almost have permission to explore ideas and concepts rather than following a plot.
Yes.
And I think you know, when you're writing a plot, you know as well as I do, an issue comes in, but it's got to serve the plot.
Yes.
Whereas literary gives you almost too much freedom.
Yes.
Not that I know, because I've never tried.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that because I've written the last 20,000 words without going back and looking at any of it, whereas before I was doing kind of 5,000 words, edit, then carry on. So these 20,000 words, I fear, are going to be quite chaotic and are going to need to be reined in a bit.
And maybe the question will be, is this serving the greater story, or is this me climbing on my soapbox and ranting?
Yes. I'm so glad I'm talking to you today, Gail, because you are telling me things that I really, really need to hear.
Hopefully our listeners need to hear them too.
And I'm also interested to hear what you've been consuming lately that's been interesting.
So it might not come as a surprise to you, but it comes as a surprise to many people. I may be the only person in the world whose New Year's resolution is to watch more TV. I really feel like I'm not consuming enough stories in a different form from books. Mm-hmm. And I feel very strongly that storytelling is what it's about, not reading. You know, I think some people are not readers, some people are watchers, some people are movie people, some people are listeners.
Yes,
And I love watching a good TV series, and I want to do it more. And what got me into that headspace was Black Doves.
Right.
Which I started watching because I saw a snippet on Facebook, and I'm a little bit embarrassed saying that. I don't know why. I find it something mortifying about discovering something through Facebook. But anyway, and it is essentially a spy story. The main character is a spy who has really gone undercover. Her whole life is a lie. Mm-hmm. She is married to a minister, but she is a spy.
Right.
And it's a flawed story. There are plot points that make absolutely no sense. Occasionally you get completely muddled about who's who and why. But I'd forgotten how much I love a good spy story, how much I love a high stakes kind of car chasey, which I don't. I say that and I think, no, that's not true. You don't love that. But I did like that. I love kind of that action of watching rather than reading. Mm-hmm. And I really, really loved it. And hopefully it's got me back into watching TV.
Okay, interesting. I remember people were talking about that series a lot over Christmas, and I think I need to go back and give that a watch.
What about you? What have you been consuming?
Well, this is going to sound slightly odd, but my son and I have started a read of War and Peace.
Oh, God, Fiona, no!
So I am an avid reader, and my daughters are avid readers, and my son is less of an avid reader. But a while ago, he picked up a short book by Dostoevsky called The Gambler, and he absolutely loved it, which I loved by proxy. And I thought, okay, maybe he will like The Russians. So I challenged him, and I said, let's read War and Peace together, and then for the rest of our lives we can say, oh yes, I've read War and Peace, you know, as a badge of honor. So I'm reading the Kindle version, he's reading the book version, and I started with such trepidation because I thought this is going to be really, really rough. And we made ourselves a target of 20 pages a day for 60 days. That's 1,200 pages. That'll get us to the end of the book. And the surprising thing to me is how story is story, even if it was written in Russian in 1860, whatever. At the moment, it's a sort of social comedy. It's a drawing room comedy. It feels a bit as if you're reading Jane Austen. It's like How to Get Your Daughters Married Off, How to Get Your Sons into a Good Career, and the machinations and the scheming that goes on. So far, we are both very entertained, and it was just a good reminder that story is story, and a good story is a good story.
Here's my question, and this is going to tell whether you are really enjoying it or not. Do you stop after your 20 pages and read something else, or do you just, is this the book that you're reading at the moment?
I thought I was just going to read the 20 pages and then go back to my real book. And my son is rather alarmingly racing ahead of me.
Oh.
So I'm kind of rushing to keep up with him, which means we are reading more than 20 pages a day. And it is kind of turning into being my real book every day. I haven't gone back to the proper book that I was reading.
The proper book. War and Peace, not being a proper book.
But we're getting out of peacetime now and we're getting more into the wartime. So maybe I'll get bored there. We'll see.
War is so boring.
But our guest today, who writes very entertaining fantasy, romantic comedies, all kinds of very gripping stuff. Our guest today is Shamiz Patel Papathanasiou. She is the author of the Selene trilogy of fantasy novels, including The Last Feather, The Eternal Shadow, The First King, and now most recently, she is the author of the romantic comedy Playing Flirty. Hi, Shamiz. Welcome and thank you for your time.
Hi, Fiona. Hi, Gail. It's so nice to be here.
Shamiz, we are so excited. You're one of those writers that we've been waiting to have on, that I'm a bit personally obsessed with. But before we get into that, let's start with, how has your writing week been?
I've been editing this week, finding all those little crutch words that I repeat a little bit too much. I think I deleted 200 cases of that from my manuscript.
Yeah,
I'm awful with that. And if I lose that, I just replace it with like just or only, another crutch word that I'll end up having to remove anyways.
And is this the edit for Playing Flirty, or is this the edit for something else?
It's the edit for something else. I'm working on a new manuscript that I'm hoping to get out on submission within the next month. So this is the very final edit, just picking up all the little issues, and then it'll go to my agent, and it is a mystery rom-com.
Okay, we're going to have to take a step back, I think, before we get into the next one.
Yes, can you tell us your origin story, your superhero origin, as Gail likes to call it? How did you, I believe you're a civil engineer in your other life, in your day job. How did you transition into writing? Is it something that's always been there for you? And then how did you move from writing to being a published author?
I think most authors, maybe not all, but most authors have been writing as far back as they can remember. It's been something that they've always loved, is stories in all its forms. And I definitely remember writing stories as a kid already. My parents, very enthusiastic, always encouraged me, even when they weren't very good. I gave up for a few years because you get told writing doesn't make you money. You have to go into, you know, as the eldest brown daughter in the family, my options were essentially engineering, law, accountancy, and like doctor. So out of that list, very, very fun and tempting list, I went with engineering. And I think at some point, all the technicalities of it and the rigidity, it made me want to have a creative outlet, and writing came back to me on and off for a few years. I joined NaNoWriMo, I think it was 2015 was my first NaNoWriMo, where I wrote, I would call it the seed of the Selene trilogy, a completely different version that had very little plot, but a world that I enjoyed, which I came back to a few years later. And ultimately, it was COVID that threw me back into writing at full force, because, well, there was nothing else to do at home.
And the engineering didn't have to engineer.
Well, I engineered, but it was so boring. You know, you were at home all day. And I started reading a lot more, which I had also become less. As soon as I started studying engineering, I had actually stopped reading for a couple years. And I started reading so much more during COVID, just being at home, and was inspired.
Shamiz, are you still working full-time as an engineer, or have you managed to make the great leap?
Just October, I made the great leap. So it's still very fresh. Okay. And a little bit scary. having been an engineer for more than 10 years, it's stressful, but also very exciting to have a little more time for writing.
I wanted to ask you about what your writing process looks like when you're actually in the thick of writing. You know, we really like the nitty-gritty, how many words do you do a day, that kind of thing, how do you plan your day. But I'm particularly interested, with no agenda of my own at all, I'm particularly interested in what was it like when you were working full-time compared to now that you're a full-time writer, what is it like and how's that change felt?
I might be writing less now, actually.
we've heard this before.
I'm still trying to figure out. I think I'm still trying to figure out a routine because I didn't only just reduce my engineering hours. I left engineering behind. So I've actually gone into a completely different industry, except I'm working half days. So with this new industry, there's also a learning curve, and I've been doing that since October. It's still feeling a little fresh. And so I haven't quite figured out my new writing routine, but I'm hoping that I'll be writing in the daytime and sleeping at night, which is really exciting.
So before you wrote at night?
Yes, I started writing at night, I would say probably around 10 p.m. and I'd go up to about midnight.
Oh my goodness. And how much would you write in that time?
If I'm in the thick of it, as you said, I would probably do about maybe 2,000, 3,000 words.
Okay, I've got one.
Very, very unedited. It's filled with that. Filled with that. I mean, 1,000 of those were that.
500 of those are that. One more question before I let you get a word in. But you've got children, don't you? Aren't you exhausted at night?
I've got one. I've got one child, which is why I only start at 10. So I'll put her to bed, and once she's asleep, do some house stuff, be with my husband a bit. And when the house is quiet and it's finally, you know, the revenge procrastination kicks in, that's when I start writing.
I'm going to have a little rest now because I'm exhausted by what you've said.
Shamiz, I'm interested in your really secret origin, which is your first book is not the first one I mentioned. It's actually a romantic comedy called An Acquired Taste. And I know from chatting to you earlier that you have a complicated relationship with this book and you look back on it with mixed feelings, but that is the kind of thing we are really very interested in. So can you tell us about that book, what you might have done differently, you know, how it was a springboard for your career, because obviously something worked because you're so successful, but how do you feel looking back on that book now?
I definitely feel an incredible amount of embarrassment that anybody read that. I wrote that, I think I was 20 years old when I wrote it, and I was working as an engineer yet, or studying, I don't know, but I know I needed that outlet. It must have happened during a very stressful time, because that's when the words tend to come. And I knew nothing, absolutely nothing. I'm obviously, like I said, engineering background, I have no writing experience other than the stories I've read. So I knew nothing about story structure. I don't even think that's a rom-com. I think it's like a rom-com drum. It's just a mesh of genres. I can't fully tell you what the hero's journey is. And it's very unedited. I just got so excited that I'd written a full story from start to finish for the first time. I was like, this is obviously a full book. I'm going to just put it out there, because everyone was like, why don't you just self-publish it on Amazon? At the time, I think it was CreateSpace. Mm-hmm. And I ran with it. Huge regret, because you can never take it off.
Can't you?
You can. You can't. You can stop it from being sold, but you can't remove it from existing.
Okay.
So you can't buy it. Thankfully, no one else will be subjected to that story. But I wouldn't say I could even attribute any of my further publications to it. But I suppose it taught me that I could finish a book, whether it was bad or not.
Well, I just have to mention that I saw on Goodreads how many good reviews that book has and how many people, you know, wrote in and said, I'm going to look out for what else this author is going to publish. So I don't think that book was as much of a failure as you think it was, because readers enjoyed it.
I still have a copy, one paperback copy. And every now and then I open it and die a little bit.
But maybe we die a little bit at every previous book, not just the first one. But I'm just thinking, Fiona, it's something we were protected from that because we weren't in the self-publishing time. You know, what you and I wrote when we were 20, we didn't have the option of self-publishing. So, and in my case, thank God, because I can absolutely
someone
see
had to
that.
Say yes to that novel.
Yeah, it wasn't going to get out there on its own, and thank God. Okay, Shamiz, I want to ask you about something quite strange. I got to know you and your work through Twitter. Somehow you came into my feed, and I followed you. I'm not calling it X. We still call it was Twitter then, and that's how we will remember it.
I'm on board with that.
And I'm quite resistant to buying books based on Twitter promotion by the author. It's a thing I actively resist doing. But in your case, you got through to me, and I bought your book because of knowing you on Twitter. And I'm going to ask you a difficult question. How did you make me do that? How did you work with Twitter?
I was going to ask you that. I was going to ask you. I'd love to do it more.
But you've engaged with Twitter in a particular way, with social media in a particular way.
I did. And it's, as you mentioned, it's now called X. And it's quite heartbreaking in a way that I don't feel that connection on Twitter anymore. So I've actually left Twitter behind. That was also a few months ago. I'm posting a bit on Threads, probably the most active on Instagram. But I do find that that closeness that I had with those Twitter followers, I have not found it elsewhere. There was a community, at least I think South African Twitter specifically, had a community where, in a way, we all felt like friends or at least acquaintances that knew a bit about each other. We tweeted a lot about our lives, and I think that brought us close. So when somebody had a baby, got married, or released a book, we were cheering each other on, and that support came through as well. Whereas now it does seem a bit bigger in a way. It's not just, it doesn't just feel South African. Maybe it's just my algorithm, and I'm not finding that one-on-one connection with as many followers as I did back then.
But it seems you had a kind of authentic connection with your followers. You weren't marketing yourself. You were putting your genuine self out there, and people like Gail connected with it. Would you say that's accurate?
I think so. I've always tried to be authentic first before anything. Sometimes it leads to oversharing, though, which is a problem.
I don't remember any oversharing. I just remember, like, you're going to buy this book eventually, so just buy it. Okay, so you wrote the first book that we won't speak of again, and then you went to the Celine trilogy and you wrote fantasy. Tell us about that. Why fantasy?
There's always been two genres that I love more than anything in the world, and that is romance and fantasy. Romanticy wasn't so much an idea in my head at the time. I think had I read a whole bunch of it before writing the Celine trilogy, I may have leaned a bit more in that direction. I'm not sure, because it really is the perfect marriage of the two genres. And I actually wrote the rom-com before the fantasy trilogy.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Yes, I wrote the rom-com. I sent it out to agents. All the secrets. I sent it out to agents, got a few rejections, felt very, very sorry for myself, and thought maybe romance isn't for me. Maybe I should try something completely different. And I sort of pivoted to fantasy to try my hand at that. And it felt quite natural. I really, really loved the story. Like I said, I picked some things up from the NaNoWriMo story that I'd abandoned a few years prior. And that one got picked up very quickly. And I think with that surge of confidence, I was like, okay, let me go back to the rom-com. And that's sort of how the genres cross paths.
Okay. Yeah, so tell us more about that. Did an international agent see The Last Feather and pick up the whole trilogy and then submit it to publishers? How did that all happen for you?
The Last Feather I did unagented. So I, instead of targeting agents with The Last Feather, I had, as I said, very, very, very sad being rejected for the rom-com. I instead submitted to a few smaller presses whose work I respected and seemed quite reputable. And Flame Tree Press picked up The Last Feather just based on a direct submission. Wow. And in the email that I remember, he said that he can see that there's room for more and wanted to know whether I'd planned anything else in the trilogy. And once I told him, they were happy to sign on every book every year. So that's basically how it got picked up. The agent came afterwards with the romance.
That is fascinating. So tell us about that. You said small presses that you respected. How did you target them? How did you find them? How did you make the decision who you were going to send to directly? I mean, I didn't even know that was a possibility.
Yes. So I love research. That is a good 60% of my personality, is the amount of research that I do on anything that I sort of get enthusiastic about. And I researched publishers who accept unsolicited manuscripts. There's quite a few in South Africa who do, because we don't really work with agents that much here. Mm-hmm. That being said, they don't usually accept fantasy, but there are some smaller ones that are doing that now. So I had to look internationally, and I think Flame Tree Press came up on one of my lists, or it was one of the authors' publishers that I'd seen. And there was just the writing community, both on Twitter and on writing forums like Writers Beware. And there's another website called Authors Publish, where they give you all of these options. And I found it incredibly helpful to just scour the internet and do your research. Yeah.
That's so interesting. Mm. I wanted to ask, I know a few years ago, when one was a writer of color, writing a character of color, there would be a discussion about how much you lean into that and how much you try to make it what was regarded as a sort of general appeal. In other words, we want white mm-hmm. people to read it as well, kind of thing. And reading The Last Feather, I was so interested in how you kind of weave into the story the fact that this is a brown protagonist. Like early on in the book, you mentioned that she eats her breakfast really fast and gets some chili flakes in her mouth. And that was just like a little prickle of, oh, okay, that's interesting. That's a sort of cultural clue going on here. And as you go through it, there are more and more clues as to what her ethnicity might be, and the extent to which you're going to make that part of the story. So were you doing that? Did it just come completely naturally, or were you being intentional with those decisions?
Both. It was intentional, but because it's natural to me, I'm Indian, but I don't live in a culturally Indian way, so to speak. A lot of the books that I read that have good Indian representation, it's very much rooted in the culture. And that is amazing. I'm sure a lot of people need it, but I don't speak Urdu. I don't say G or call my parents by their names in whatever the beloved Urdu name would be. I don't wear cultural clothing. I don't do any of those things, but I'm still Indian. And so I essentially wanted to write my lifestyle into a character, which not only would appeal to me, but also to any other, I don't want to say displaced brown person, but any other brown person who is part of an ethnicity, technically speaking, but doesn't really feel fully part of that community because they weren't raised that way or because they don't live in that community. I grew up in South Africa. I went to school with all kinds of kids. It's South Africa is not quite as homogenous as a lot of Eastern countries or European countries, where, you know, you go to Greece, there's Greek people, You're going to be raised Greek. South Africa, you sort of get raised with a mesh of cultures. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I wanted to put out there, whether somebody's reading it being Indian, whether an Indonesian living in America reads it, that they're relating to the fact that this is a brown person having a full fantasy adventure with romance and not sort of being tied to the specifics that they might not be able to relate to.
Nice. I'm very interested in the plotting of fantasy because I cannot imagine being able to do it myself. So I want to ask you a little bit about what does that look like? How much do you plot before you start writing? How much do you world build before you start writing? What does that writing journey look like for a fantasy writer?
For The Last Feather, it was very chaotic. Again, I guess with being my first fantasy book, I just dove in, blank page, let's go. I did have the NaNoWriMo draft at the back of my mind, which in a way could count as plotting or world building at the very least. So I did have some of this world already formulated with these ideas. Only after the first draft, and I write a very, very messy first draft, do I go and think of all the questions that one has to ask when writing a fantasy. You know, how does the politics work? Is there currency? Do they have plumbing? And you sort of work through those questions and make your decisions. And then I incorporate all of that during my edits. By the time we got to book two, I had the world a lot more fleshed out, which I knew would take place in book three. But book two, a little bit of a spoiler for anyone listening, takes place in a secondary realm. And I actually planned and plotted that realm a little bit more, now knowing what goes into building an alternate reality.
And but it sounds like you plotted book two and three together a bit more than book one, which you didn't realize you were going to be doing a full trilogy.
I knew it would be a trilogy,
okay.
But I didn't know what book two would be.
Okay.
I knew how the story started and I knew how the story ended. And so two and three ended up having to go together just for it to be cohesive and to make sure that it's, you know, hitting all the right spots and you don't get that awful, boring, saggy middle book.
I always want to ask fantasy writers, to what extent is your world building completely out of your imagination, and to what extent do you rely on already established tropes? So if you're going to, for example, have dragons, then they need to kind of fit in with a dragon world that's already been established by other authors, by a kind of fantasy convention of what dragons would look like. If you're going to have a secondary realm, is its hierarchy going to be sort of medieval in flavor, or is it going to be something completely different? Were you already a fantasy fangirl who leaned into established tropes, or were you pulling it completely out of your own imagination?
I would say it was a mix of things. Because it was a portal fantasy, technically, very little happens in our world. So I always hesitate to call it that. But it is technically a portal fantasy. And so pulling Cassia into this world, it didn't make sense for me personally to have it set in the medieval era. And in addition to that, the first, who are the inhabitants of this world, are able to cross over to our world. And I don't understand why they would continue living in their medieval state if they could come back and take things that they wanted, whether it was ideas or items or anything. So the Selene realm is a mesh of what feels right for fantasy, but also feels right for somebody coming from our world.
And our world is very subtly, it is a South African world. I mean, I remember at a moment where I hadn't kind of thought about that, because you write in a way, and I have to say this, you write with an international flavor. Like, it really, it feels like you are reading one of the top, like, well-established fantasy writers when you read your books. And then a kudu came along and it gave me quite a fright because I'd forgotten that we were anywhere near South Africa. And I was like, a kudu.
I also noticed the kudu. And then no sooner had I noticed it than it was dead. And I was like, oh, the kudu.
Talk to us about that South Africa versus not South Africa in a fantasy world.
Thank you for your lovely words, firstly, and I'm sorry about the kudu, but I definitely, my intention is to appeal to an international audience. As much as I love South Africa and all of its flavors, you want the readers of the world to buy the book for it to be a success. But that I'm still South African, and I do believe that that is what will make my voice seem fresher, or set me apart from other authors. So for me, it just made sense for it to be a kudu. It felt like the most natural animal to throw in there. And there's definitely little, in all my novels, there's a tiny little mention just to remind the reader that the author is South African. Not quite as big of a reminder as saying they're going to bri, but... Yeah. But just a little something being thrown in there as a nod to where I'm from.
It's very interesting. That kudu made me very happy. I actually, to such a point, I blocked out that it died. I'm a bit distressed here. I'd forgotten that.
Shamiz, you use different points of view. So we'll have Cassia's point of view, our protagonist, and then we're in Lucas's point of view. How did you find that? Was it easy to switch between different characters, or is it difficult to change gears?
Writing in third, I think, makes it easier, because I find when I'm writing in first, I get a little too intimate with the character I'm writing. And third does allow a little bit of distance. You can see them separate from your own body, if that makes sense, or if it makes me sound crazy, I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. So swapping between the two, I didn't find any issue. I think it's also because Cassia and Lucas both came to me fully formed, I would say, and their voices, I understood them quite fully. Their voices were very strong already, and swapping between the two felt quite natural, especially because Cassia came into the Selene trilogy knowing nothing about the realm, and Lucas knew everything. So it was quite nice being able to lean into somebody that had all these questions and then somebody that had all the answers. But Lucas was, he was a lot of fun to write in with all his boyish ways. And I personally didn't find any issue, maybe because I've read a lot of fantasy, which is often male dominated, and I could lead into that. But when it came to writing Lachlan and being in his mind when he is having romantic feelings, I suppose in a way it's what you would hope your love interest is thinking about. So it's a bit of fantasy fulfillment within fantasy.
Mm. Writing that down.
So you were kind of creating romanticy maybe before the genre was on the tip of everyone's tongue as it is now. Were you just blending your two loves, because you said you love romance and you love fantasy, were you just blending them because that's what you love, or were you creating something that you knew had an established audience, sort of Sarah J. Maas or whatever the antecedents might be?
I was writing what I wanted to read. I love romance, but what I love more than romance is a really strong romantic subplot. Mm-hmm. Because I'm always interested in the high stakes that are happening elsewhere, whether it's in fantasy, even in a rom-com. I want to know whether she's going to get that job. I'm really invested in what happened to her mom at the end. But I want all the stomach flutters. I want to blush. I want all of that. So I mixed it in the ratios that felt right. That being said, I don't think they were the right ratios for the wider audience. People tend to either want hard fantasy with a very small romantic subplot, or proper full-blown romanticy where the plot actually cannot go on without the romance that's happening. And in my case, it's not really falling into either side of that, which makes it a little bit hard to market.
I'm going to say for me it was exactly right. And part of it is because something I want to ask you about, which is that romanticy has become very spicy. And you know, we
very, you know, very spicy.
And it really, really, I'm not a prude. I don't mind reading sex, but when I'm deep into a fantasy, I don't want 20 pages of kinky sex. And for me, you've kind of got that balance exactly right. You don't throw us into 20 pages of kinky sex. Do you think it's something in future you're going to have to engage with more, the spicy content of romantasy? And how do you feel about it?
I suppose if I really wanted to write sort of with money first in mind, then that would be great. My agent has asked if I've got a romantasy in me, which I could. I have ideas, but I don't enjoy reading such... I don't enjoy the 20 pages of kinky sex mid-war scene. I'm always like, what are you doing? People are dying outside. Exactly. Go and tend to them.
Exactly.
We could use your abilities on the war field. What are you doing? You're wasting time. Your best friend's bleeding out.
And it always is in the middle of the war scene.
It always is. It always is. And I don't judge anyone who reads it. It's a good time if you manage to just suspend your disbelief, and they're very easy to read, but I don't think I want to write them. I think when I do eventually circle back to fantasy, it's going to be at the same ratio, and I'm just going to hope it finds you and the other readers like you who are looking for that ratio.
The two genres that you write in, romance and fantasy, are very much being driven by social media at the moment, by BookTok, which has become such a powerful force. It can make or break careers. Have you tried to embrace that at all? Are you in the BookTok scene? Are you trying to harness its power to put behind your books?
There was a time when I did a social media experiment, a TikTok experiment, where for 2 weeks, I uploaded, I think it was 4 videos a day.
Yes. Wow.
I made the content in advance. I wanted to do my research. Like I said, love research. I did 4 videos a day so that I could post them at different times to see whether any time made a difference for different audiences, because you obviously get all that data. I also made different style videos. So one being a skit, one being like, you know, the page flip with the quote that appears, aesthetic reels with the vibes of the book. And I tried all these different things, jumping on. Some would jump on trends, some would just use a trendy audio. I did a few with a VPN on to see if it makes a difference with the audience. And after 2 weeks, I'm pleased to tell you that I found no pattern.
I don't know.
Absolutely no pattern. And at that point, I think my heart just broke because I'd put in so much effort. I was like, I don't care about TikTok anymore.
I don't know if that's good news or bad news. Like,
it's awful. It's I would love for my book to get the BookTokers' attentions. But in both cases, as you mentioned, it's got a spicy scene, The Eternal Shadow, but it's not 20 pages of it, and neither is the rom-com. And BookTok is definitely focused on the spicier books. At least that's the ones I've been seeing as being more popular. So maybe it's not for their audience as well.
And are the publishers creating any of that content these days, or are they leaving it all up to the authors to do the BookTok content?
As far as I know, it's all the authors. Mostly it's self-published authors that have taken to BookTok, and then traditional authors felt the need to do it too. But I haven't had any pressure from either of my publishers to perform on social media.
So you've just mentioned circling back to fantasy. So let's talk about the circling away from fantasy and the writing a rom-com. And I'm also very interested in how one plots a rom-com. Talk to us about the story seed. How do you what do you feel is the key to a good story seed for a rom-com?
For me, it's the dynamic between the two love interests, the main character and the love interest. So as soon as I figured out that dynamic, why they're attracted to each other and why they can't be together or what holds them apart, that's the seed. everything else, oftentimes you could change the environment and take that same couple and put them elsewhere and people wouldn't care because the dynamic and the chemistry is so strong. So if I can hit the right chemistry, I run with what feels right that'll assist them in the story, because in a rom-com, they are the plot.
So that was an interesting pivot from fantasy to romantic comedy. I believe you also switched publishers at that stage.
Yes.
That's correct. Okay. And I just see that the marketing is different for this book. We've got an illustrated cover featuring the two love interests, and we've also got a name change. You are Shamiz Patel on the cover of that book. So was that quite intentional? Were you deliberately pivoting to market yourself in a different way, or did it come from the new publisher?
The rom-com is the one that got agented, and so it was submitted completely separately to new publishers, and very lucky Forever picked it up, and they did the cover according to the genre norms. So the rom-com books are generally illustrated nowadays, and so they were just carrying on with the trend. The editor specifically asked me if we could drop Papathanasio because it is, and I quote, not searchable, which is true.
Interesting.
And I had no issue with it. I joked that, you know, a handful of people might think I divorced in the last few years, but I agree. Papathanasio is a very challenging surname, not only to spell, but to pronounce. If books are being recommended by word of mouth, no one's going to remember it.
It's always interested me that you initially chose to keep it as part of your name, because I've got to be honest, and I have a slightly Greek background, but I go Shamiz Patel, just look up Shamiz Patel when I'm recommending the book. So I'm interested that you used it at all in the first place.
It just didn't occur to me that it was a problem. I suppose for me, having held the surname now for so many years, it seems completely normal. And only afterward did I realize may not have been the best decision.
And your publisher
but going forward, I think.
You?
No, I think they just made it so large on the cover. They were like, we're going to get people to see this name. They're going to learn it.
We will educate people, and we are educated.
One thing that I think you do very well in your books is make us care about the characters and make us invested in their journey. And in The Last Feather, there is this very endearing character of the younger sister who is, it seems, dying of a mysterious illness that nobody can get to the bottom of. And we have a sense that this other realm that Lucas is inhabiting will somehow be the key to this mystery, and that the stakes are centered around this beloved younger sister. And it's such a powerful mechanism to make us care. Is that also something that just comes easily and naturally to you, or do you consciously think, what are the stakes here? How am I going to build the tension?
Yeah, I do consider that intentionally. I like to put myself in my character's shoes, despite our different personalities. You know, what would make me, somebody who is notoriously scared of the wilderness, go and do such a thing? And it would definitely be to save somebody that I love. And I will say that Keller, who is the younger sister, when she first came to me, she did come to me in the form of my cousin who I lost a few years ago. And I think in a moment of, you know, complete denial and vulnerability, you wish that you could have saved them. And you know what would have helped? Having the ability to heal people. So
and travel to different realms.
And travel to different realms. So, you know, just finding cures. So it was a little therapeutic to write about somebody that could be saved.
Very nice. I like that idea of writing as a reinventing a past trauma, that you can live it out in a different way. I want to ask you about, you internationally published. How has that felt on the local scene? Do you feel accepted by the local writing scene? Do you feel known by the local reader? Or do you feel like you are more an international property, so to speak?
It's a bit of both. I don't feel fully international because I'm not there. I've never been there. I've never seen my book in a Barnes & Noble in person. I've seen photos, which is awesome. But I haven't been able to be there. I haven't been able to really talk to any of those readers except, maybe through a review on Instagram. If they tag me in something, I'll reply. They'll reply. And that's it. That's where it ends. In person in South Africa, I do get to mix with other readers and other South African authors. So I definitely still feel part of the South African author group. But at the same time, because my books, as you mentioned, aren't rooted in being South African, it doesn't feel like a South African book always. It goes on the fantasy shelf. It doesn't go on the South African author shelf. And so there is still a little bit of a separation. It's once again, it's me and the hard fantasy and the romanticism. I'm somewhere in the middle.
And the reception to fantasy. So I'm going to, a few years ago, you were on a panel at Kingsmead that I was very excited about. And they put the panel at the end of the day. And as a result, it was poorly attended. And I want to know, do you think that we don't have that fantasy reading audience? Because I thought it was going to be packed. I thought it was one of the most interesting panels of the day. Do you think we are not somehow ready for fantasy here? Like, what's going on with that?
I think for a while we weren't. Which is probably why South African publishers don't even accept fantasy manuscripts. But I do think that that's growing, largely because of romanticy, especially in the female readership. That being said, I think that panel specifically was, even though I'm a fantasy author, I think that it was a lot more thematic and based on almost magic realism than it is proper genre fantasy. And just last year, we hosted a fantasy event at Exclusive Books called Otherworld. And it had three panels from about 10 a.m. until 3. And each panel was completely packed with readers who just love fantasy. And I think that opportunity just isn't granted. And I do think that publishers and lit events should be leaning into genre fiction, which often comes with a bit of a stigma of being lesser than.
And now that you have undergone this rebrand as Shamise Patel and you're writing romantic comedies, do you have a career trajectory going forward? Do you have a plan? Are you going to write more romantic comedies? What can we kind of hope to see from you next?
In the near future, there will be more romantic comedies, as it was a 2-book deal. So there will be a second book. After that, I'm writing. So I've written a rom-com mystery that I would like to get out in the world as soon as possible. And then I've got another rom-com idea. There's a sci-fi idea brewing. It really is whatever inspires me at the time. I know that it is recommended you write in the same genre to appease your audience. But I hope that some of my readers will cross genres for me. And if not, we'll find some new friends. And I'll do my best to get books to them as often as possible.
I will follow you into a shopping list. Honestly, I cannot wait to see what you will do with sci-fi. I got all excited by that.
So, Shamise, we always like to ask our guests what they have been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on them.
Reading, I read Unromance, which was a rom-com released on the same day as Playing Flirty, and I was almost mad at how good it was. I had a great time with it. I've read recently Better Once Than Never, which is published by a friend of mine. Really steamy, or spicy actually, beyond steamy. It was also a good time. And I'm listening to The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Is that the title? The prequel to The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. And I watched the film almost a year ago. And the book is just, it's too good. I pause and I'm like, I don't know how she writes like this. I don't understand it. I feel addicted to it. The writing is just so brilliant. So yes, that is what I'm technically listening to.
And can we expect audio from you? Do you already have an audio backlist of your works?
For the Celine trilogy, I recently asked the publisher about it, and they said that they are hoping to release an audiobook, which is why they haven't released my audio rights back to me, because they do have a plan. So crossing fingers for that. The Playing Flirty audiobook has been published. So it's out in the world being listened to by people, which is very strange because I listened to the first chapter, and I don't know about you, but listening to somebody read your words back into your brain that wrote it feels very close to insanity.
It's very strange.
Well, that's good news for readers who want to be listeners as well. We hope everyone checks out your Celine trilogy of fantasy novels, and especially we hope that everyone buys Playing Flirty, because it's out now, it's available. I had a read and it is really, really lovely. It's great fun.
And I'm a bit gobsmacked by this because I thought it wasn't out yet, and I've been patiently waiting, and I don't know how I missed the fact that it's really out there.
It's published in the States, so the paperbacks are only reaching South Africa in February.
But I'm going to download it right this very minute. I've been wondering what to read next. Now we know.
Maybe it'll inspire that rom-com out of you.
Shamiz, we're not going to talk about that rom-com ever again. Let that idea rest in peace as it should.
Shamiz, this has been great fun, and we thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I really had a good time.
Gail, talking to Shamiz is almost as much fun as reading her books, didn't you find?
I really loved it. You know, I've heard her speak before and I knew she'd be a great guest, and I love her books. You might have picked that up. I found that very inspiring.
In what ways did it inspire you?
So I think for me, when she talked about the different genres, and she almost didn't feel herself contained by genre. She didn't feel, I've made this fantasy thing and now I have to be a fantasy writer. And especially at the end when she said science fiction, I felt like a wave of inspiration overcome me, like, oh my goodness, you can actually have different ideas, and it's so exciting. You know, this is what I love about writing, that you can go into different worlds and have different ideas, and they don't all have to be in the same genre. And I felt very bizarrely inspired by that. What do you think about that?
Ooh, I wish I could say the same. And I think earlier in my career, I was very inspired by that. Just that freedom to write whatever I liked, to lean into different genres, because I don't only read in one genre. I read across multiple genres. And I thought, well, then that must mean I write across multiple
genres
as
well.
And
you do. Successfully.
I do, and I have. But I don't know how successfully. I feel as though if I had my time over again, I would be more intentional about creating a particular career for myself, becoming known as this kind of a writer, and within fairly loose boundaries, sticking to that. It's kind of the career that you've had. Your traditionally published career is as the domestic noir writer. It's what you're known as, it's what people love you for. Your digitally published career is in the cozy mystery genre, which is not completely different from what else you write, but it was sort of creating yourselves under a new name of Katie Gale, so you were free to do that. Hasn't that worked for you? Hasn't it been better?
Has it resulted in great commercial success? Yeah, no, it hasn't. You know, the cozy mystery, yes. So that's interesting. And I think it is because it is such a genre and such a well-established genre. And yes, we have spoken to our publisher about would Katie Gale be allowed to write in another genre? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that they said you could pick one other. So okay. Katie Gale would be allowed to write rom-coms too.
Okay.
But Katie Gale cannot write hard Scandinavian noir because that would, you know, it's got to be something that fits in with the Katie Gale profile.
Mm-hmm.
But she would be allowed to write a similar but different genre. So that's very interesting because they are very good at building brands and building writer brands. In my personal life, I don't... Yeah, I suppose you've got a point. Like, I do quite like that I'm known for a particular type of book, but then what if I write something else? What's going to happen? And it makes me a bit anxious about writing something else. I think I want to try and be more open to different types of writing, but I want to ask you something.
Mm.
You've said, if I had my time again, like, you're 97. And you and I both know we're actually at the beginning of our productive years. Going forward, if Fiona Snickers has to be one type of writer, what's she going to be?
I think I would lean into the readable and accessible and hopefully fairly fun and plot-driven. That's a lot of qualifiers, literary fiction.
Very interesting.
I've mentioned before on here that I want to protect myself from AI.
Yes.
I want to write the kind of books that can't yet be written by AI. And I feel as though, I mean, I've also done Cozy Mystery. Mm. I feel as though AI could come for Cozy Mystery and take it over.
I agree with you to a point.
Right. What is that point?
I really do believe that the reader is still going to find the human written book more satisfying because it will make slightly more sense. It will have more empathy. Listen, I think AI will probably reach a point where it can write a great cozy mystery.
Right.
Because it is genre writing and it is a formula.
Mm.
And AI can learn a formula. And I think maybe the point you make is a strong one, that literary fiction is the formula it can't learn. But at the same time, I'm also not frightened of AI because the readers of those genres are extreme readers. There's space for all of us, even the AI.
right. Yes, that's interesting. Yes. Yeah, so it's, I don't know, it feels like a watershed year. It feels like a year where maybe I've got to start making some decisions. And you have ventured outside your genre. You told us for a while that you were writing a rom-com. And, I mean, that could have been the breakout into a new genre, but
abandoned it. Well, yeah, and Shamiz alluded to it, so I obviously spoke about it quite loudly and everywhere. And we will see, but I found the writing process was not satisfying. I stopped that book at 50,000 words, which is a strange place to stop a book because you're over the worst part of the book.
Yes.
I might go back to it and see what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized I don't want to be a rom-com writer.
Okay. Interesting.
I think it's going to be a year where we do a lot of exploring in how we see ourselves as brands. And hopefully we're going to take our listeners along for the ride.
I think we will. And I'm certainly looking forward to it. And also to getting more engagement from our listeners, which we love. We are on all social media across the board, so we hope that you write in, give us your thoughts, send us your questions. We see all of it, we engage with all of it, and we love all of it. So please keep listening.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.